Support for our podcast comes from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering precision cancer treatment guided by advanced genomic testing through its new Centers for Advanced Individual Medicine. Advanced genomic testing may reveal treatment options that were not considered previously. Learn more at cancercenter.com.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later, roasting science, the tips you'll be thankful for next week when your dinner guests taste your succulent turkey, and how you can create a broiler map of the hot spots in your oven. Very important. But first,
the most spectacular science shocker ever filmed. Too real to be science fiction. Now, science fact.
Lights, camera, action on our latest edition of Science Goes to the Movies. This week, a story of interspecies communication between us and aliens.
Dr. Banks? Hey, what are you doing?
Yeah, hi. They need to see me.
Take it off her hazmat suit. Dr. Banks.
Good.
Are you okay?
Direct contamination.
They need to see me.
Dr. Banks.
She's walking towards the screen.
I hope the suspense is killing you. That's a scene from the new film Arrival, where Amy Adams' character, a linguist, takes off her hazmat suit in an alien spacecraft so she can better communicate with the aliens that have arrived on Earth. Yes, the scene ends with an interspecies high five. We've got two scientists and newly minted film critics here to pick apart the film. What would an actual linguist do if one had to talk to an alien? How do we even begin to craft understandings? My guests have some experience in this field. Doug Vakoch is president of MEDI International. That's Messaging Extraterrestrial Intelligence, based out in San Francisco, California. Sherry Wells Jensen, a linguist, xenolinguist, and associate professor of English at Bowling Green State University in Bowling Green, Ohio. But before we get down to brass tacks, that's our spoiler alert signal. We are not holding back in this conversation. So if you haven't seen Arrival yet and you don't want to, hear the spoilers because we're going to talk a little bit about them, plug your ears. Thank you both for taking time to join us today. Thank you.
Glad to join you.
Delighted to be here.
Sherry, I'll bite. What is a xenolinguist?
It's not a thing that most people get to talk about. So if you just take linguist and then you deploy your favorite xeno prefix, you get language, the study of languages that are out there somewhere that we haven't been yet, and in a way that we haven't even begun to think about. And we don't have a lot of data, in xenolinguistics quite yet, but we're building the background for it.
Hmm. And Doug Vakoch, MEDI is an organization dedicated to messaging extraterrestrial intelligence? Is that correct?
Well, that's right. For over 50 years, astronomers have been searching for signals from extraterrestrials using radio telescopes, optical telescopes. MEDI is the flip side of that. So in addition to searching, we're also dedicated to sending intentional signals, trying to prompt a reply from ET.
Mm-hmm. So how much, Sherry, did Louise's approach to communicating mirror how it should or should work in real life?
Well, she had the good fortune to have the aliens right almost literally at her fingertips, right with the high five there. And that's not something we necessarily expect in the next, 15 to 20 years, as far as we know. Physics tells us that probably they're not going to zap faster than light right into our backyards. But if they were there, if we could do that, then the things that the film got wrong are kind of small interstellar potatoes. I think she did a really excellent job.
And that really is the point, and one of the points of the movies is how do we communicate with something that, in this film really is not speaking to us. It's talking in symbolic language, isn't it?
It's giving us the opportunity to think intelligently and artistically, but maybe with the emphasis on intelligently, about how we would really get that job done. What would some of the barriers be, And could we really succeed? And it's asking all the right questions.
Well, let's get into some of those questions. Sherry and Doug, let's say that you were the one tapped for Dr. Louise Banks, Amy Adams' character, or Ian Donnelly, Jeremy Renner's character, who is a mathematician in this thing. What would your first move be?
You mean, of course, after I finished the jumping up and down and screaming part, right?
Yes, yeah,
that would be first. But if we did have the opportunity to be face to face, we would face what linguists and philosophers call the Gavagai problem, which is, I hold up a rock, I say rock. Do you, as the alien species, do you understand that to be the thing in my hand? Do you understand that to mean I'm holding something up? Do you understand that to mean, look out, I've got a rock, I might throw it? Do you understand that to mean potential energy? What even is that? So I would be ready to experiment a lot, to make more mistakes, especially at first, than I get things right, and do just what they did in the movie, which is do a thing, do another thing, do another thing. Okay, then go down and sit around and have coffee for a day and a half and think about all the things you did and sort out how you misunderstood, and then go back and try again and make more mistakes and hopefully different mistakes, and then come back and try again and try again.
Doug, we want to weigh in on this?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would want to use the same approach. I think there was this nice dichotomy set up in the movie between the theoretical physicist who says, hey, we got to start with some binary digits and then move to the Fibonacci series. And Amy Adams is saying, you know, language and communication is messy. And the person who brought them together, Forrest Whitaker's character, the colonel, says we need both of these perspectives. And I think that's the reality. In fact, communication is a very fluid, very complicated process. And we see the kind of misinterpretations and our desire to leap to a conclusion earlier than we should. So, you know, the big cliffhanger is, what does it mean when the aliens say, offer weapon? Are they offering us a weapon? Are they going to offer the weapon to one of the 12 sites where they have spacecraft hovering over? And or, as Amy Adams says, and similar to the Gavagai problem that Sherry is talking about, is it really a weapon, or is it a tool, or is it a gift? And what we discover ultimately is they're talking about language. And language, of course, is a tool, and sometimes we use it as a vicious weapon, and sometimes it becomes a gift for us. Mm-hmm. So I think the complexity of communication, that's what I would really expect the extraterrestrials to realize, that we are going to make those mistakes. It's mm-hmm. inevitable, and so we have to hold in abeyance all of our interpretations.
And Sherry, there's really that one fantastic scene where Amy Adams' character breaks down just how hard it is to ask an alien, what is your purpose on Earth?
It's the first thing you want to know, but it's the last thing you're going to find out, right? So they do a really good job of breaking that apart and saying, well, first off, what do you mean by you? Well, first thing, and then how do I ask a question? And then go ahead and even define for me in easy words what purpose means. It's incredibly complicated.
Right. What do we take for granted when we go in as humans? So we'll take for granted about talking to human beings that may not be true with aliens.
I think the mistake we make is inevitable, is that we assume that we're starting from ourselves. We assume that we're starting from language as we know it and communication as we know it. And we can do no other, because even as we decide, I'm going to assume nothing, I'm going to start from zero, we're starting from what we understand zero to be, not what they might understand zero to be. And so we have to be able to unthink ourselves at every step and treat even our successes as potential failures, mm-hmm. which sounds depressing, but it's actually kind of great.
You mentioned Doug. Go ahead.
I think the flip side, too, is to actually being able to recognize the successes when they happen. So there's one scene where they're checking in with everyone at the 12 sites around the world. You made any progress? And the Australian liaison checks in and says, no, you know, we play them some sounds and they repeat them back and no progress here. But, you know, that's monumental to actually have someone recognize you're trying to say something and they repeat it back. You're being heard. And so I think the key is to get a lot of different perspectives coming into this so that we can recognize when we're making some progress. The challenge that we face is not getting caught up sometimes in our successes even. So when folks were trying to decode Mayan hieroglyphs, they made some great success in the early days by recognizing some of the elements of a calendar, some of the mathematical components. And then they thought the whole thing is mathematical. But no, sometimes it's talking about grain shipments and commerce. And so sometimes even the successes get in our way. So it's always being able to step back and say, what else might this mean?
Well, you know, talking about math, we've always said that that's like the universal language, the universal means of communication. But was it weird to you then that the aliens didn't understand algebra? But they...
Well, it's a little weird. So there's this throwaway comment that they do recognize prime numbers. So they know, okay, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, these are numbers. You can't divide them by 2 or 3, any other number, just themselves and 1. So they recognize some math, but they don't recognize algebra. How in the world do you build a spacecraft that can travel between the stars and you don't know the quadratic equation, for example? So ax squared plus bx plus c equals 0. So that's considered a fundamental concept of algebra. But if you stop and think a second, there's a lot of stuff packed into that simple concept. You have to recognize that the A, B, and C are constants, so it's a number that doesn't change. X is a variable. X squared is the same number multiplied by itself. You've got to understand addition of the different parts. You have to understand that the two sides of the equation are equal. And so even one of the most fundamental concepts of what we consider relatively simple math has so much packed into it. And maybe, in fact, the aliens are very conversant with algebra, but instead of talking about it in terms of distinct numbers, they graph it and look at it visually. And we do that as well. So I think, you know, it makes sense to me that math is universal. If you don't know something like 2 plus 2 equals 4, you're not going to be a very good engineer on this world or any other world. But the way we represent that, the way we talk about it, could be radically different. And to me, that's the beauty of this story, because it says we should be ready to rethink something as fundamental as our sense of time if we encounter a radically other being.
Yes, I give away too much here. We're going to take a break, come back, and talk lots more with Sherry Wells Jensen, Doug Vakoch. Our number, 844-724-8255. We'll take a break. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. Support for Science Friday comes from Harry's. This holiday season, instead of giving another tie he'll wear maybe once a month, how about something he can use and enjoy every day? A razor from Harry's. You know, the thing I love best about Harry's is not just how close and comfortable of a shave I get. It's not just because Harry's razors have a softer flex hinge with a lubricating strip that just glides across my face. What I like best is it has a single trimmer blade for those hard-to-reach places, you know, so I don't nick that spot under my nose like I used to with my old razor. It's worth the price of the razor alone. And speaking of price, Harry's are still just $2 per blade. That's half of what I used to pay at the drugstore, and I love that too. To get you to try Harry's and find out for yourself how great the shave is, they are offering a super deal. Harry's will send you their popular trial set, which includes a razor, 5-blade cartridge, and shaving gel free when you sign up for a shave plan. You only just pay shipping. Plus, right now, there's a special offer for Science Friday fans. Enter code FRIDAY at checkout to get a post-shave bomb added to your order for free. So go to harrys.com right now and enter code FRIDAY at checkout to claim your free trial set and post-shave bomb. Send a gift someone will thank you for every day. And, you know, pick one up for yourself at the same time, too. That's harrys.com, code FRIDAY. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're midway through a discussion about the new sci-fi film Arrival, the story of aliens arriving on Earth, how we might go about talking to them. It's a really, really interesting movie. A reminder, this conversation contains spoilers, so if you want to see the movie and don't want to spoil it for you, you know, just pay attention. I'm talking with Doug Vakoch, president of METI International, that stands for Messaging and Extraterrestrial Intelligence, Sherry Wells Jensen, linguist and xenolinguist at Bowling Green State University. Our number, 844-724-8255. What about this hypothesis that language rewires our brain. Do you know about that, Sherry?
Yeah, it's one of the best things in every intro to linguistics class, right?
So, is there a technical word for that?
You could call it the Sabir-Whorf hypothesis or linguistic relativity. Those are both very Googleable. And the idea is that the way we speak and the words we have for things and the way our grammar allows those things and actions to interact influences or controls, depending on if you want the weak version or the strong version, how you think about them. So this is, it's tricky, right? Because there is some influence. There's probably some influence. We have some data to indicate that the words you have for color terms might influence how you perceive color. But you don't want to go too far. For example, in Japanese, there's one word that means foot and leg, the whole shebang, right? Just one word for it. But because they have one word and they don't have two words, one for leg and one for foot, you're not going to walk around and believe that Japanese people don't know they have feet.
Right.
So we don't have languages on Earth that can dramatically rewire your brain. So whatever happened to the linguist character in the movie wasn't language as we understand it on Earth or language as we have it on Earth. It was sort of language plus LSD or something like that.
Right.
But it wasn't the same.
Yeah. One of the breakthroughs that she made in the movie when she was actually able to go up to the glass and touch her hand on it and meet the limb of the other alien. And she said it was so important not to be able to just talk to it, but to make eye contact with it for language. How important is that?
That would really depend on what the species were. You could be an alien species with technology flying around from planet to planet without visual perception. We often assume that they will, because it's awfully useful to people on Earth, to many species on Earth, to be able to see. But not necessarily. What's useful and necessary is that you have intellect and sensory input. Mm. But what those sensory inputs are like, we can leave those unspecified because we know we need them, but we don't know which ones are absolutely necessary or what kinds those are going to be.
Mm-hmm. Doug, this is a movie where aliens are real. They show up on Earth and they wait to talk for us to talk to them. Is this how you think we'll actually encounter intelligent?
Oh, absolutely. I am so jealous of Amy Adams. I mean, she gets to be there right face to face with them. She tries something. It doesn't work. She gets to try something else. No. In the real world scenario, the greatest hope is that the nearest star is populated. And that would take 8 years for a round trip exchange. Much more likely, the nearest intelligent civilization could be hundreds or thousands of light years away. And so it's hundreds or thousands of years for a round trip exchange. What that means is you have to try to have a foolproof, self-decoding message, which is impossible to do with perfection. So the goal really is to try to say at least something that makes sense. And so, you know, it's much more like instead of understanding another language as we learn it on Earth, you're a child, you speak a language, you learn by context. It's more like decoding Egyptian hieroglyphs. And the big challenge there was some of the assumptions we made early on stood in the way. So there's this idea since the ancient Greeks that each of those hieroglyphs stood for an abstract concept. And it wasn't until the early 19th century, after Napoleon's army dug up the Rosetta Stone in Rosetta, Egypt, and there was this parallel text, two different versions of Egyptian, one of Greek, and you could make correlations between the two that this brilliant linguist in France, Champollion, said, hey, wait a second. Sometimes a glyph doesn't mean this abstract idea. Sometimes it's just a sound. And so I think that the key is always to be able to step back to make assumptions. And then, you know, our challenge is to try to find something like a cosmic Rosetta Stone.
Yeah,
and will it be the periodic table of elements?
Well,
if you're a chemist on another world, will they recognize it?
I have a question coming in from Rob in Whittier, California, who's sort of basically asking that question. Rob?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I love this show.
Thanks.
I've always been thinking of that for years. You know, if these beings are that intelligent, they're going to have a grasp of chemistry, which means they have to know what the proton count of each atom is. And if you just keep broadcasting that over and over and over and over, if they're intelligent, they're going to say, hey, this is the periodic table, or at least this is the This is the chemistry we know of. And I don't know if they do that in SETI. I don't know. I just have always thought that.
Yeah, good point.
You know, I think it's a good intuition. It maps onto some of the best proposals we've had. So the mathematician Carl DeVito at the University of Arizona developed a language to communicate with extraterrestrials. It's based on set theory. So it can talk about numbers in a two-dimensional array, but that's exactly what the periodic table of elements is. That there is not only do you count, you know, from 1 to 92 for the naturally occurring elements, but you show that as you repeat them and line them up in a certain pattern, there are chemical regularities that you see. And so the hope is that the extraterrestrials will have something like the periodic table. They may line it up a bit differently than we do, but if they know about the composition of stars and their own world, maybe mm-hmm. they'll recognize our representation.
Well, last question for you, Sherry. How close to reality? I mean, if you were that person trying to, would it be for you to do the same thing she did? I mean, are there any big bloopers in the movie? I guess is what I'm asking.
Oh, no, I don't think there were any big bloopers, but we missed a lot of the error, I would say. So she's writing on her little whiteboard. They automatically understood what she was doing. If you're writing, what are they paying attention to? The angle of the pen, the track of the pen, what you do with the pen afterward? Or would they assume that they should look at the residue that the pen leaves behind, which is something that you have to figure out? So I think what we missed in the movie was all of the years that was wrong.
They didn't have a whole lot of time to do it, though, right?
There was an
army standing by there all around the world, so they were sort of under a little bit of pressure to get results. As part of the drama of the movie, the film is Arrival. It's a really great, fun think piece. It reminded me of Close Encounters of the Third Kind when they used music to communicate with the aliens there, but here they're using symbolic language trying to figure it out. Doug Vakoch, I'm sorry, I keep getting your name wrong, Doug. Vakoch, president of METI International, stands for Messaging Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Sherry Wells Jensen, linguist and xenolinguist at Bowling Green State University. Thank you both for taking time to be with us and translating the movie a little bit for us. It's great. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Catherine, this turkey tastes half as good as it looks. I think we're all in for a very big treat.
Why are you crying?
I told you we put it in too early.
Oh, it's just a little dry. It's fine.
I told you.
Here's the heart.
That's one of my favorite scenes in any movie. That was, of course, Clark Griswold, master of the disaster holiday meal. And while this scene from National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation is one of the funniest, I think, it ain't when it happens to you, is it? We've all been there. You've roasted a perfectly golden brown turkey. You've basted it for hours, cooked it low and slow, and resisted opening that door every 5 minutes. And when you finally carve it up and take that first taste, you get that sad, stringy bite. Ugh, the one that makes you reach for the gravy, right? A glass of water. Well, we're here to help you this holiday to become a master of your roast. And I'm not just talking about the turkey. We're going to tackle side dishes, too. The unsung heroes of any Thanksgiving meal. What can you do to balance the sweetness in your sweet potatoes? Which apples are best for baking? How can you create a broiler map? Yeah, we all need this to tell you the hot spots in your oven. My next guests are here to add a dash of science to our recipes. Molly Birnbaum and Dan Souza are co-editors of the new book, Cook Science, How to Unlock Flavor in 50 of Our Favorite Ingredients from America's Test Kitchen. They join me here in our CUNY studios. Welcome to
Thank
Science
you.
Friday.
Thanks for having us.
And if you need help with a particular ingredient or a side dish you're trying to perfect this holiday, we want to help you out, so give us a call. Our number is 844-724-8255. 844-SCI-TALK, or you can tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI. Don't you love that scene in that movie?
Oh, my God. That's one of my favorite movies of all time. I watch it every season before Christmas.
It is. It gets it right on.
Oh, yeah. That thing just opens up and everyone. And then the scene afterward where they're all chewing the skin and pouring like cups of gravy on it. It's priceless.
How as foodologists, how common is that? kind of mistake with the turkey.
So I think that that goes a little bit too far, but I think a lot of people have a difficult time with turkey. I mean, for one thing, it's people really cook it pretty much once a year, so you don't kind of learn the mistakes and then apply those next year. So you got to start with a really good recipe to get good results.
So that is the is that the first biggest mistake? Get a good recipe.
Yeah, it's start with a well-tested recipe. I think is key, and and if you try it one year and you make a little change, make note of it, and then kind of follow through on that next year. But turkey itself poses some challenges in that it's really an odd thing to roast in terms of its shape and in terms of the composition of its muscle. So if you look at the breast, which is primarily white meat, those muscles are made for flight, which turkeys don't do very much, but they're kind of fast twitch muscles. They're very lean and they can dry out really quickly. Then the legs, which do a lot more work, have a lot more connective tissue, more myoglobin, more oxygen goes there, and those need more heat to break down. So you're trying to roast two things at once and have them both be done perfectly. It's kind of an odd challenge.
And a helpful solution is what? How to do that?
We have a few helpful solutions for that. One of the most easy things to do is actually break down the turkey a little bit so that you roast the breast separately from the legs. You can roast them all in the same pan, but if you separate them, they end up finishing right around the same time when the breast reaches 165 or so and the legs reach 175 or so degrees Fahrenheit. And just having them separately, because the breast is so much bigger, it cooks a little bit slower.
Now, one of the real problems I have found over the years is finding the actual temperature of the oven.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, my ovens are awful, 25, 50 degrees sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So that thermometer is really important to go in. If it says roast it for X number of hours at 350, you better know that your oven is only 325, right?
100%, yeah. Ovens go out of calibration really easily. And I mean, when was the last time you calibrated your oven? Right. Yeah. I think most people.
I don't even know how to do that.
Right.
How do you do that?
It depends on the oven. In the owner's manual, which I'm sure you still have.
Of course.
Would tell you that. But we find that an oven thermometer that you put in there is really important. So you want a nice new one in there, and you can adjust your oven based on what the reading you're getting out of it, and that's an easy way to kind of make it work. And then you can have a professional calibrate it as well. But they can vary a ton. They're not the most accurate instrument in the kitchen. But another thermometer that's really important is a digital instant read thermometer, and that's for taking the temperature of the bird itself when it's close to done. And that's super important because you really can't judge it any other way, and you're going to mess it up if you don't know. You want to pull it at 160, 165 in the white meat. That's the safe temperature. Anything over that, you're not doing it any favors.
And let me just remind everybody, I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Dan Souza and Molly Birnbaum of Cook Science, How to Unlock Flavor in 50 of Our Favorite Ingredients. And, when you cook in the oven, the oven is full.
Right.
It is really chock full of stuff with the side dishes, but yet it's uneven temperature in different places. How do you know where it's hot and where it's cold? Can you do something?
Sure. So one thing is most turkeys can rest for a really long time after they come out of the oven. So it's really nice to get your turkey done and let it rest up to an hour even. Mm-hmm. It's so big, huge thermal mass, it'll stay warm for a long time, freeze up your oven to do a lot of other stuff. But if you're using your broiler, which is great for finishing the top of casseroles on Thanksgiving, and it's the fastest cooking method you can do in the oven, we came up with a really cool technique. We call it a broiler map. So on a rimmed baking sheet, you line it with white bread, and you put it the distance from the broiler that you're going to put your food, and you turn the broiler on, and you let it go until some part of the bread is basically burnt. Take it out, and you'd be amazed at how uneven it is. But you really get to see what parts get hot, what parts are cool. So when you're broiling something, you can adjust and put the food in just the right place.
Mm-hmm. We asked our Twitter audience for some questions in advance, and we got a couple here. Lyndon asks, is it really worthwhile to bring the meat up to room temperature before cooking?
No, it's not totally necessary to bring the turkey up to room temperature before cooking. I think the most important thing is the temperature at which you take it out of the oven. So getting that breast meat to around 160, 165, and getting the legs to 170, 175. It might take just a little bit longer if the turkey is colder when you put it in, but other than that, it doesn't really matter.
Our own Jen Kwok asks, does basting really do anything? It seems to just drip off.
It does do something, but it's not really what you want it to do. So what basting does is you put a hot liquid on the outside of it, and you actually get evaporative cooling. It evaporates off just like water on our skin on a hot day, and it cools the surface down. So it'll actually slow down the speed of cooking of your turkey, which is not really something you want necessarily. It also adds liquid to the exterior, and what you're trying to do is drive moisture out of the skin so that it can then crisp and brown. So you don't need to baste. It's kind of a waste of time.
Hmm. That's kind of a waste of time. Okay, that's a good answer.
You've got plenty of other things to do on Thanksgiving. Don't bother basting.
Let's go to Nico in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is about brining. I know brining all meats tend to make it more tender, but it's so counterintuitive. You'd think sodium would actually make it drier. How does brining actually work?
It seemed like salt would pull the moisture out of the meat.
Right, right. And sometimes it does. So if you want to dry salt your turkey, what happens first is the salt pulls the moisture out, but then it forms a concentrated brine, and then the salt starts to move into the turkey through diffusion. And that's what happens in a brine as well, a water-salt mixture. And as the salt moves into the turkey, it actually changes some of the proteins in there, helping them to hold on to water more easily, so that when you cook it, it maintains more moisture. And it also seasons the turkey throughout as the salt moves in throughout the whole turkey.
It's also really important the percentage of your brine. So we use one in the test kitchen that's usually between 6 and 9%. If you go too high, you are just drawing moisture out. There's enough dissolved solids inside of muscle fibers that the water, through osmotic pressure, still wants to go in. But if it gets too high, it's going
to
pull it
out. So what cup per water is that, 6 to 9%?
Oh, you're quizzing me. off the top of my head... Yeah, I'm not sure off the top of my head.
We'll find that during the break.
Yes, definitely. I got to look it up in the book.
We got to look it up. The book is Cook Science, How to Unlock Flavor in 50 of Our Favorite Ingredients. Talking with Dan Souza and Molly Birnbaum on number 844-724-8255. Hoping a little bit of research and science will help you get a better and more flavorful turkey as well as other side dishes. We'll get to you and also tweet us at SciFry. We'll be back right after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This hour, we're talking about how to roast the perfect bird and all those side dishes this holiday. Molly Birnbaum and Dan Souza are walking us through a few tips. They're co-editors of the new book, Cook Science, How to Unlock Flavor in 50 of Our Favorite Ingredients from America's Test Kitchen. And if you're looking for tips to maximize the flavor of your ingredients and dishes this Thanksgiving, give us a call, 844-724-8255. 844-SCI-TALK, or you can tweet us at SciFry. Let's go to the green part. I'm going to try to sneak in some healthy stuff into the meal. You can make a kale salad. It's not your typical side dish, but I'm learning now that you massage your kale, Molly. Is that what you do with kale? You massage it?
That is definitely something you can do with your kale. So kale has two issues that I think make it hard to love it raw in a salad. One is that it's kind of tough, and the second that it can be very bitter. And to help with the toughness of kale, massaging it, actually running your fingers over it to help the leaves loosen up a little bit. You can use a rolling pin over a bag. It really helps tenderize the leaves. But what happens when you do that is it makes the flavor of kale a little bit more bitter. And that's because the flavor of kale really only happens when you start to damage the cells within it, because then an enzyme interacts with a sulfur-containing compound to create a totally new compound that they wouldn't interact if the cells weren't damaged. But this new compound is very bitter.
Mm-hmm. I see you've got a bag. Is that a bag of kale?
I do have a bag of kale.
We brought you kale.
We have two samples of kale here. One, we worked really hard on figuring out how to get kale to taste less bitter.
Right. All right, I've got one sample here.
You have one sample there. That is raw kale that has just been lightly torn up.
Take a bite.
For a salad.
Mm-hmm. Now, and this might not, neither of them might be super pleasant because there's no dressing or anything, but that is just kale that's been washed and torn up.
Tastes okay.
Tastes okay,
tastes
right?
Green.
Exactly. Tastes, green. Tastes healthy.
Okay, now this one.
This one is massaged.
Massaged kale.
And so what we did is
I could tell you, it is much more bitter.
Mm-hmm.
We need dressing. Dressing!
Yeah, I mean, sometimes adding a lot of dressing to very bitter kale can help. And so one thing we did in the book was try and figure out how to make kale less bitter. Mm-hmm. And we discovered that rinsing it after you massage it and create all this bitter flavor can lessen the bitterness of the kale.
Hey, will this happen to other food, other vegetables that you know, maybe broccoli or anything like that too?
Well, it's interesting.
The same effect?
It's interesting. There's a number of different vegetables that kind of go through this. So in the brassica family, which kale is and cabbage, they really don't have flavor until you damage the cell. So you can control that. The same thing is true with alliums. So your onions, garlic, shallots, the more you cut those, the more intense the flavor is going to be. Even how you slice an onion, whether you slice it pole to pole or the opposite direction, can actually change the amount of flavor. So there's a lot of vegetables that kind of fall into that camp.
Mm-hmm. Another favorite is a green bean casserole. Mm-hmm. I love that. It's sort of gooped up with mushroom soup. Mm-hmm. Everybody uses mushroom soup in something.
Of course.
You say try roasting the green beans. Why is that good for bringing out the flavor?
Well, green beans are interesting in that they're a very hearty vegetable, and that's because most of their texture comes from the fact that we're eating the pod and not the immature seeds within them. And because of this, you can roast them for a long time and actually keep the texture and keep them together so that they stay intact. And this is because they have a lot of cellulose and pectin in this pod. So roasting them for a longer time or braising them allows them to soak up the flavor of the braising liquid in a really nice way. So you can let them in the oven for a long time, still get really good flavor.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones to Rachel in Pittsburgh. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
Go ahead. You're on.
Well, thanks for taking my call. I'm looking forward to bringing a side dish to my boyfriend's Thanksgiving. And I was really wanting to make the kind of quintessential sweet potato, marshmallow, nut sort of casserole. But it always ends up tasting more like a dessert instead of a side. So I was wondering if you all had any suggestions on making it a little less sweet.
Well, that's a tricky one. When you put marshmallows on it, you're almost kind of asking for that dessert aspect to it. But, the one thing that's really interesting about sweet potatoes is that they kind of change. From when you pick them, they're relatively high in starch and low in sugar. And then during storage, there's an enzyme called amylase that converts some of that starch to sugar. So they get sweeter during storage and then a little bit sweeter during cooking. So longer, slower cooking can increase their sweetness a little bit. So I would recommend that you want to cook them actually relatively quickly. So if you're going to make them mashed first and then put them in the casserole, put them in the water, bring them right up and boil them and get them done that way, as opposed to, slow roasting or anything like that. And then I would have to say leaving off the marshmallows would probably help you out a lot.
It's not really a potato, is it? A sweet potato. Is it a real potato? Yeah?
It's in the potato family. But yeah, it is quite different than white potatoes.
And it's not the same as yams. Those are often names that are lumped together. But sweet potatoes and yams are totally different.
One is more starchy than the other?
Yes.
And yams are enormous. They're like the size of a small car. That's an exaggeration, but they're much, much bigger than sweet potatoes.
I see if I can get a lot of it. I'm going to keep that vision. Let's go to Val in Sacramento. Hi, Val.
Hey. So my question is, I have a whole bunch of apples that are, that besides making apple juice and apple pie, I have no idea what to do with them. And for the holiday, I was wondering, how could I incorporate those apples into side dishes or other foods besides apple pie and apple juice?
I love my apple pie, though. So. Yeah, what else can you do with apples besides, you go apple picking, you're coming home with a bushel.
You are. You're coming home with a lot. Yeah. Well, so it really depends on what the kind of apples that you pick, actually. So we did a really interesting test in the book where we figured out, we baked a huge variety of apples, and we also cooked them sous vide in little bags at 185 degrees, which is the temperature at which pectin breaks down very rapidly. And we saw a huge difference between like the red delicious, golden delicious apples, which turn to mush very, very fast and are great for something like applesauce, and Granny Smith's, Pink Ladies, and Honeycrisp, which are on the other end, which stay firm for a long time. So those are great for baking. You can bake them whole. You can kind of core them out and use some of that apple chopped up with other more savory flavors stuffed back in. Mm-hmm. Those make a really nice baked apple. We also have in the book a really nice French apple tart, which is a little bit different than an apple pie. It uses golden delicious, and they're nice and soft. There's a mash underneath and then some softened ones on top. And that's a little more elegant, I think, than an American apple pie.
It's a beautiful tart, this tart. They're shaped in a rosette on top, and it's actually quite easy to make.
Tartapom, as they say.
Exactly.
In
France.
We'll leave the pronunciations to you on that.
I love that one. Let's go to Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Hi, my name is Renee, and I, first of all, I'm a huge fan of America's Test Kitchen. We watch it all the time.
Awesome.
My question is regarding the Maillard reaction. How does that actually improve the flavor of your food? And then kind of along the same lines with brining your food, if you put like sugar or honey or maple syrup, does that actually impart the flavor since those molecules are so much bigger than salt, or are you wasting good maple syrup?
These are both really good questions. So for the Maillard one, what's kind of happening during that reaction is you have amino acids reacting with reducing sugars, which are really small sugars, and it improves the flavor because it creates hundreds of new flavor compounds. There's a few reactions that go on during it, and you get creation of compounds and then destruction and creation of even more, and you end up with something that is really, really complex. And if you compare that to something like caramelization, which is just sugar, it's infinitely more interesting flavor. So that's what's going on with the Maillard reaction. In terms of brining sugar, yes, sugar will move a bit into the meat. It has a little bit of the same effect of salt in terms of pulling moisture out. So we do include sugar in a fair number of our brines. You have to be careful if you're doing something that you're going to roast at a relatively high temperature, because you can get additional browning whether you want it or not if you add sugar. We like it on pork a lot because that sweetness works really well with it.
Let's see if we can get one last call or two in. Let's go to Washington, D.C. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Hi there.
I got an idea I try. I think it's terribly easy. Well, I have a roasting pan that's roughly the same width as my bird, and I just cook it upside down or with the breast side down, and it seems like the juices of the turkey keep the breast moist, and when the leg's done, the whole thing's done, and no fuss, no muss.
I like that.
Wow, yeah.
So I think that's great, and you're definitely exposing that dark meat to, you know, the heat that's in the oven and protecting the breast underneath. At least the one problem there is you're probably not getting great browning on the skin. So a lot of our recipes, we start that way down, and we give the dark meat a head start and then flip it about halfway through. So you get a little more even cooking, which is also nice.
Mm-hmm. We also have an interesting recipe that we published recently in which you use a baking stone heated up really hot in
like
the oven.
Like a pizza, which with pizza like on?
Yeah, exactly. And you have that underneath the roasting pan, so you still have the breast up but the legs down. So it gets much hotter on the bottom, and so the legs cook a little bit more quickly, and it all finishes at the same time.
Wow, that's a great tip. Let's talk about leftovers, because we're going to have a few.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, everything seems to taste better, doesn't it? I mean,
a
maybe
lot
there's
of stuff does,
a lot
yeah.
of stuff. Is that in our mind, or is there really something going on in the chemistry of what's going on in the dish?
There really is something going on with it. I actually don't know a ton about the chemistry behind it. Sometimes you can get these kind of warmed over flavors that aren't very pleasant, but things like stews, a lot of times the flavors just get a lot more complex. In terms of like flavor movement going into things, I think it's a good method for like a lot of stews and soups and things like that.
If you want some great methods, I suggest you get a copy of Cook Science: How to Unlock Flavor in 50 of Our Favorite Ingredients from America's Test Kitchen. You can read an excerpt of the book about the best baking apples. Yeah, a lot of different apples in there. Jonathan's are my favorite. It's on our website at sciencefriday.com/Thanksgiving. Molly Birnbaum and Dan Souza, co-editors of Cook Science. Thank you for coming back.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Nice to have you. It's that time of the year, leather weather. Time to bust out those leather jackets to beat that nip in the air, right? But how about an alternative? Something that you would make you into a truly fun guy. And I'm talking about a mushroom leather jacket. Yeah, mushroom leather. Yeah, it's possible. A leather jacket made from mushrooms. Our future may be made of fungi. Here to talk about that, the subject of her latest article on sciencefriday.com, is Chow Tu, Science Friday story producer and reporter for the web. And there is a macroscope video about mushroom leather, too, up on our website at sciencefriday.com/mushroom. I'm telling you, you don't want to miss this mini feature up there. Welcome, Chow. Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
I don't think anybody has ever heard of mushroom leather before.
No, I think this is a pretty new concept, but I think it might be something in the future that we may come across more often.
Now tell us what is mushroom leather? What is made out of pure mushrooms?
So this is not like the fruiting part of the mushroom that you're used to eating, like on top of pizza or whatever. This is actually the part of the mushroom called the mycelium. So that's the root-like part of the mushroom that grows onto different substrates like wood or sawdust and corn cobs. It's very fibrous, it's thread-like, it grows exponentially. And what's really great about mycelium is that you can manipulate it into different shapes and different textures as it grows. So one thing you can do is you can feed it different stuff, or you can change the humidity or the temperature of the growing environment, and that sorts of molds it into different sorts of shapes and everything. And so with this company, what they're doing is they're creating a leather-like material using mycelium. And at this point, the company, in just 2 weeks, they can grow a sheet of mycelium that's 27 square feet. So that's comparable to a big cow.
Wow. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. So I've seen from the video, this is it does look like a piece of cowhide. Yeah. And it's as tough and rough as cowhide, but it's made by the stuff underground that the mushrooms grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's supposed to be pretty durable. They say that it's stronger than synthetic leather, and it's as strong as deer skin, but they're still trying to test out its wear and tear and how long it can last.
So you mentioned the company called MycoWorks, and we actually visited?
We got a video talking to the CTO, who is Phil Ross, and he's sort of the person who created this leather-like material. So Phil Ross, he's actually an artist, and he started out also as a chef for a couple years. And that's when he started to learn about mushrooms and how to grow them. And then he started kind of making art out of the mycelium. So he was starting to make this sort of building material, these bricks. And he started creating chairs and different sorts of structures. So people started really getting interested in what else this material could be used for. And so that's when he started MycoWorks. So at this point, MycoWorks has made things like synthetic wood, furniture, and other things. And Ross actually has this pretty big vision for where this stuff could go beyond leather. So we have a clip from Luke's macroscope video. It's up right now on sciencefriday.com.
My hope is that this will become a globalized industry, that well beyond my lifetime or even what MycoWorks is setting up, that this will just become a standard way that human beings are going to figure out how to provide for themselves. Eventually, you will be growing your solar panels and telephones and other types of things like that out of fungus-based substrate. To me, that is why I keep on pursuing them. I've witnessed it and I know it as a truth, so I'm following that truth.
But in the meantime,
we welcome all the vegan biker gangs to come and find us.
vegan biker gangs.
Yeah.
It really is as durable as leather for bikers?
Yeah, we'll see. Maybe we'll see them out on the road soon.
You said it was as strong as deer skin.
Yeah.
Wow. But what if I get it wet? Now, right? It's made out of a material that, you know, feels like leather, but will repel water.
Yeah, it's supposed to be water resistant, and it's actually naturally antibiotic as well. So, yeah, it should stand up to some stuff.
But we don't know, because it's not really commercially available on a wide scale, we don't know what it's going to cost.
No, not yet. Yeah, it's not available yet. They're still working with designers to sort of figure out what kind of leather material these designers want to make. Like, we can make bags or shoes or leather jackets. So could be out there pretty soon.
We will not call it Naga anything. We need to find up a new name for it, right?
Michael.
Thank you, Chow. Chow Tu is Science Friday's story producer and reporter for the web. You can read her feature and see the macroscope video. It is a mind blower. It's on our website. It's sciencefriday.com/mushroom. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And we're on Facebook. Or they're all week long on Twitter also. And you can send us email. Go to the website at sciencefriday.com. That's where that video is up. And you can send us email, scifry@sciencefriday.com. Have a great weekend. Next week is our special Thanksgiving Day week. We're going to have Ig Nobel Prize Awards. You know, we always play that the day after Thanksgiving. So if you're looking forward to that, you'll be able to hear this year's Ig Nobel Prize.